Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI reflects on the solemnity of Christ the King. We hear of the terrible predicament of the people of Zimbabwe and of how it is getting harder and harder for them to keep the flame of hope alive. And film critic Peter Malone tells us all about a new film on Charles Darwin, his doubts and his certainties, his personal battle as a scientist and as a family man of his time. Christ is a king who dominates with love, who does not impose himself, but rather respects human freedom. Pope Benedict XVI's words came on Sunday as he addressed those present in St. Peter's Square. He was reflecting on the solemnity of Christ the King before praying the Midday Angelus. Charles Collins has this report.
Pope Benedict on Sunday said the cross is the paradoxical sign of the kingship of Christ. Speaking before reciting the Angelus in St. Peter's Square, the Holy Father said the regal power of Christ is not of the kings of this world. It is the divine power to give eternal life, to free us from evil, and to defeat the dominion of death. The solemnity of Christ the King concludes the liturgical year. The Pope said Christ's power of love can soften a hardened heart, bring peace to the most bitter conflict, and turn people to hope in the greatest darkness.
His kingdom is not built upon the power of this world, but comes to us when we accept the presence of God in our hearts and live in this light. Let us strive to follow closely in the footsteps of Christ, the servant King, and bear constant witness to his merciful love and his saving truth.
The Pope said it's a power that cannot impose anything and always respects our freedom. After the Angelus, the Pope spoke about Sister Marie Alphonsine Gattis. The Jerusalem-born saint was being beatified on Sunday in Nazareth. The Pope said her spirituality has at its heart the intense devotion to the Virgin Mary, the beacon of a life wholly consecrated to God. I'm Charles Collins.
Thanks there to Charles Collins for that report. I've been wanting to do a descriptive program of the tragic humanitarian situation in Zimbabwe for a long, long time, but it's difficult. In the past months, I've put together programs about the political situation there, about the HIV pandemic, about the plight of the elderly and the AIDS orphans, about the lack of medical and educational infrastructures, about the rampant human rights abuses and the indifference of the rest of the world. But I feel I've never managed to convey my deep feelings and thoughts about that beautiful country and its resilient people. I've never managed to put all the dramatic issues they face together on one canvas and paint a satisfying landscape or portrait of the tragic reality of a resourceful country that used to be known as the breadbasket of Southern Africa, and today is a hellhole for its inhabitants who are dying in huge numbers of HIV/AIDS, cholera and malnutrition, or are seeking refuge or asylum in countries where unemployment is not rife and human rights more or less respected. And then recently, I met a man who had much to say about Zimbabwe because of what he does. I found him particularly inspiring and asked him to speak to me about his work there, about his thoughts on the situation, and about his own hopes for the people. First of all, I said to him, please introduce yourself.
Garvin Augustine, I am from Kingston, Jamaica. I belong to an association called Mustard Seed Communities. We look after children with disabilities and children who are infected or affected by HIV/AIDS. We started 32 years ago in Kingston, Jamaica, and we've expanded to Nicaragua, to the Dominican Republic. We started a project in Haiti, but we had to temporarily shut it down a couple of years ago, but we are reopening it this year. And in 2001, we went into Zimbabwe, where we have a mission there, looking after children, caring for AIDS orphans, running schools, and so on.
I meet you here in the Beda College. Are you studying to be a priest, I assume?
Yes, you're correct. I started here in 2007 for 4 years to become a priest. I can't say that I've always felt this way. When I joined Mustard Seed in 1996, I just wanted to be a volunteer, doing social work, you know. But I lived in community. It's a lay association, so there are a few of us who live in community with the founder, who is Father Gregory Ramkisoon. And over the years, I just felt that I had a vocation to the priesthood, I had a calling, and I wanted to commit myself more fully to this life. So I started here at the Beda 2 years ago, and I have 2 more years to do. But in the off periods, when I'm not studying, I go back to my mission work in Zimbabwe and in Jamaica.
I was going to ask you, have you actually been to your mission in Zimbabwe? Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Well, first I'll go back a little further. When we were invited to Zimbabwe by the then Archbishop of Bulawayo, Pius Mubi, he wanted us to come there and assist with the HIV pandemic. With a lot of resistance, I went. I must say that I did not really want to go.
Why not?
Because of all the things that you hear about Zimbabwe in the media and so on. You know, life seemed very difficult. And indeed it was, and it still is. But I went there and I found that there was probably an even greater crisis in 2001, and that is people were hungry. So apart from the scourge of AIDS, you have a situation where thousands of people were just starving. Nothing in the shops, the agricultural sector had collapsed. People didn't have jobs, people didn't have money to buy anything, and people were just going hungry. So we made a decision there and then to focus on feeding people rather than tackling the AIDS crisis, which would have been another hurdle trying to get the AIDS drugs in, which still is a problem up to today. So we used our resources to start what we call nutrition programs, feeding children on a daily basis, and that has continued up to today. Right now, we feed on average 700 children each day, and it's the only meal they get. And we have 4 feeding centers where we feed these children, and you have hundreds of children coming, and inevitably the food runs out. And they're so orderly, and they're so disciplined, and they come with their little dishes, their little bowls, and when the food is finished, those who don't get just turn away and go back. And
heartbreaking.
It is. And we have tried very hard to increase, but because of several factors in the country, we have to do things very quietly and very simply, not attracting too much attention and so on.
As is everyone I have ever spoken to about Zimbabwe, whether inside the country or out, Garvin is careful not to spell out situations that could in any way create problems for people living there. But it is no secret that not all of the aid money meant for humanitarian projects in Zimbabwe reaches its rightful destination.
Where do you get the food? Where do you get the money?
Well, like all NGOs, we have resources and funding externally. From the United States and from England, we have donors who give us money, and we buy things and import. So the only people who can really bring food into the country are the wealthy people who have the money, or the non-profit organizations, charitable organizations that can bring food from South Africa or Botswana and so on.
There's no possibility of buying food that's produced in Zimbabwe?
Well, there's nothing being produced right now, and for a while now. But I must say, this over the last 6-8 months, it has changed a bit in that there's now food in the stores in Zimbabwe. So you can buy things, imported goods, there locally.
That's if you've got US dollars or South African rand.
Precisely. You have to have the US dollar, the pound, or the rand. And again, people don't have that. You know, you have an unemployment situation of 80-85%. I mean, so it's people just cannot afford. So we do the best we can. Apart from the feeding program, we also started 3 schools, nursery schools, kindergartens, where we have right now about 200 children attending class every day for half the day. And they also get a meal with as coming. So again, that they get their nutrition. And that, I must say, we've worked closely with the Ministry of Education there to get our schools approved, and they have approved it, and we are working with them in educating these children, preparing them for primary level education.
Are these mostly children who come from the rural areas, or are they based in Bulawayo, which is quite a big city, isn't it?
Yes, well, we are based just on the outskirts of Bulawayo, our main mission, and we get children from all parts, from the rural parts, coming walking for miles to come to school. We built a church there as well, so we have people coming from all areas, all parts around, surrounding areas, for miles walking to come to church on a Sunday. And the other centers also are sort of in high density areas, what we call low income, very densely populated areas.
Slums.
Yes, yes. So we focus all our efforts right now in Bulawayo. There aren't many other NGOs operating for varied reasons. It is difficult to move things, equipment, medical supplies. And that's another big challenge. I mean, then the professionals have left for one reason or another. So you have a shortage of doctors, a shortage of nurses, teachers, no medical supplies. We really hope, I mean, we try to keep hope alive in offering what we offer. And hopefully, eventually, people will begin to come back home and meet the needs of the people there.
These words immediately brought to my mind something I'd recently seen on the news. Zimbabwean Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai on a journey to Europe and to the United States to garner support and funding for his nation's young unity government, appealed to Zimbabwean expats to return home and help rebuild their country.
Let me state here, and I'll state it boldly, that Zimbabweans must come home.
As you can hear, his address was repeatedly interrupted by jeering and chanting by the crowd, demanding that first President Robert Mugabe must step down.
You've been to Zimbabwe often in these past years. The situation has been getting worse and worse and worse, and there was an election and there was hopes that things might change a little bit. Maybe they are slightly, very slightly. You've been speaking to the people there. What are their hopes? How do they feel about their future?
It's difficult to keep the fire of hope alive. People don't seem to have much hope. They don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. The impression I get is that people are still crossing the border in spite of the changes in the last few months. I think that has yet to be translated into real, tangible differences on the ground. I mean, yes, as I said, there's food in the shops now, but people can't buy it. I mean, that's the only thing you can say that has changed. But the professionals still haven't come back. I mean, we haven't seen anything. The medical services are still the same way. So it's difficult to keep hope alive. People don't see a promising future as yet. And until things really start changing, I don't know. I don't know that people will feel good about their country. I mean, it's a beautiful country. I don't think it will take much to turn it back around. A lot of infrastructure that was there 10, 15 years ago is still there, but crumbling slowly. So if things change in the next 6-8 months, I think the country can turn around quickly in a couple of years.
And how important is it, I asked Garvin, to keep the story of the Zimbabwean people in the news? Since the election a few months ago, it has rapidly disappeared from the headlines.
I think it's important. In any crisis situation, it's important to keep people, keep the message out there that people are hungry, that people are dying. In this day and age, people are still dying of AIDS. I mean, why? When in the West, that is unheard of. Why are people dying of AIDS in Africa? Why are people hungry in Africa when in the West, you know, we waste so much? And so I think it's important to keep those stories in the news, whether it's Zimbabwe, whether it's Uganda, whether it's Somalia. I mean, it's important to keep these stories where people are sensitized, where people are informed, in spite of whatever, in spite of differences, in spite of political differences. I think we have a responsibility to care for the other. We can't allow political or ideological differences to prevent us caring for our brother and sister.
It must be quite heartbreaking to work with children, especially. Is it something you do personally? Do you have any special memory of any particular child or situation?
Well, there's one child. Yes, I love children. I mean, I have so many children. There's one child in Zimbabwe. I remember this old man came. This is about 6 years ago, just when we started. And he brought this baby, who I thought was about 1 year old at the time, a little baby, and asked if we could look after this child. He walked for about 30 miles with this child and said the child's parents are dead and his wife, which is the child's grandmother, also passed away and he couldn't look after the child. And we took the child, and he was actually 3 years old, but he was so malnourished that he looked like he was 1 year. And we fed him, and we cleaned him, and we medicated him, and now he is bright. And in fact, funny enough, his name is Bright. And he's a very bright young lad. He's still with us. We never saw the man again. We don't know where he disappeared to. But Bright thinks of me as his father. And now he's about, 8 years old, and he's doing well in school. We got him, he went through our own preschool, and then now he's in primary school, and we're looking after him. That's just one of many stories in Zimbabwe and in Jamaica. I mean, similar
so kinds. We hope for a bright future.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, we hope for a bright future for Bright. And
absolutely.
those children, actually, we tell them that we hope that they will be the future of Zimbabwe.
Well, I find it really difficult to get my mind and my emotions round some of the statistics I read. But I know that Bright's story is the story of so many children in Zimbabwe, where, according to figures released in 2007, one in every four children is an orphan. Notwithstanding the sadness, notwithstanding the dramaticity of his tale, Garvin appears really happy and grateful to be part of life in Zimbabwe.
They're lovely people, and yes, they name their children after, you know, things that that happen, or, you know, sunshine, that sort of thing. But they are wonderful, wonderful, loving, caring people. I remember, again, just a little story. I remember when I first went there, coming from the West, I mean, you're sort of, this culture is so different. Somebody died in the area, and I didn't go to the house. And the people were so angry with me, and I couldn't understand why. And they said, when afterwards they said that, I mean, culturally, once someone dies within a certain radius of where you are expected to attend the funeral, you're expected to come and mourn with the family, which is so different to the West. I mean, you sometimes you don't even know who your neighbor is, and if the person dies, you don't go. But even if you don't know the person, you go and you show your face and you mourn with them, you grieve with them, you attend the funeral. And that's the kind of caring, I suppose that's why they've survived for so long, because caring is second nature to them. And I've learned so much from that, that you know, nobody is a stranger. Everyone is your brother and your sister and your father and your mother. And there's a little old lady, she's about 90 years old, and every time I go back for Christmas or for the summer, in the last 2 years since I've been here in Rome, she just runs up to me and she says, "Oh, my son, little old lady who's as poor as ever." And she would bring something that from her garden for me. She can't afford, but yet she would still give, and she treats me like a son. I mean, that's the kind of that we have so much to learn that we can learn from that sort of culture. Beautiful people.
It's over to my friend, film critic, Peter Malone, who heads the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Today he gives us his thoughts and impressions of a film entitled Creation, all to do with the figure and the studies of Charles Darwin.
It is about Charles Darwin. I think Creation is a misleading title because I don't think in the whole film the word Genesis is mentioned. It's rather his writing on the origin of species, and while that wouldn't be a marketable name for a film, I don't suppose, but that really is the context of the film.
Mr. Darwin, sir, it is time to write your book.
My title will be On the Origin of Species.
All of nature is a battlefield. Remind me where I read that.
Clear evidence of transformation over millions of years.
Reading your review, you say it's more a personal film than a film about science or religion, in the sense that it doesn't really create any controversy about evolution or creationism.
No, it's the kind of film where when you hear what it's about, I wonder to myself, well, maybe this will need some kind of a statement from Cygnus about issues of science and religion. But when I saw it, there's really no need for any kind of statement. It's very much more a personalised look at Darwin and his family and one of his children who died. I mean, the science is there and there are some statements about it, but by and large it's giving a portrait, I suppose, of Darwin as a human being who was a scientist.
I'm a scientist. I dare not study for the fear of seeing more clearly what is already as plain as day.
Although it does have Thomas Huxley in it saying, "You've killed God, sir."
You've killed God, sir.
Yes, it comes early enough in the film, and we really don't see much of Huxley at all. It's Toby Jones saying this line, but it haunts Darwin in a way, but I don't think that's still a theme. It's featured, but that's about it. I think rather Darwin's problem about his theories is that he's an Anglican, that he's been brought up in, I suppose, an 18th and 19th century Anglicanism, and that requires belief in God, an understanding of the scriptures. This is pre-literary form studies. And his wife is very devout, and it's she who really challenges him all the time and perhaps makes him feel in some ways guilty inside that his investigations and his studies are leading him away from a literal understanding of creation.
Do you not care that you and I may be separated for all eternity?
But did you find it interesting historically?
Yes and no. I don't think they emphasised, you know, the historical setting so much. At the beginning, there are a couple of flashbacks to his going to Argentina and Patagonia, and the expedition, Fitzroy bringing back some of the Patagonians to display to the king, and then they're returning. So there's that atmosphere of British colonialism in it. But that all happens more at the beginning, and the rest of it focuses... They use a device, let me put it this way. He loves his daughter Anne, and she dies. And it's a bit hard at times, because he's talking to her, whether it's memories or flashbacks to what happened, or she's entering into the present as a kind of sounding board for him.
It's she who says, "What is it you are so scared of? It's only a theory."
What do you say, scared of? It's only a theory.
It changes everything. Suppose the whole world stopped believing that God had any sort of plan for us. Apart from anything else, it would break your mother's heart.
Yes, so she's a device, and apparently the book on which it's based, I think from her grandson or great-grandson of Darwin himself, does focus on this kind of experience of Darwin, very much introverted, very much into himself. And eventually his wife then persuading him to really finish the book and publish it.
I've finished. You decide.
Do you think Catholics will like it?
Yes, I would think so. In a way, it's a nice, elegant film, really. And because it's gentle on issues of science and religion and recent thought in the Catholic tradition has no difficulties with major evolutionary theory, it shouldn't bother anyone on that grounds.
I'll bet that half the nation would cheerfully see you burned at the stake if they knew what you were writing, but you have friends too, and all of us are fighting the same battle.
I gather, however... this is a gossipy kind of thing one reads, that some of the more fundamentalist groups in the United States are not very happy about a film on Darwin, and there was a question whether it's even got a distributor for the United States. But that's a very American question, not one for us, I don't think.
I wonder if the Osservatorio Romano has had a chance to see it yet.
I haven't heard any report of it, but
given
the reviews in L'Osservatorio this year, they seem to... respect the films that they're discussing. So I'd be very interested to see the particular perspective they have on this. But if it gets hit over the head, it's like squatting a gnat.
Very nice metaphor. Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much. That was Peter Malone, head of the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.